I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're continuing our series on the poetry of love this hour, figuring out where or if it fits into our lives today. Do we still make room, not for the saccharine lyrics of a pop love song, but do we still make room for the finest writers to help us understand those emotions of love? Does our idea of love poetry also include lines and ideas that might be more tragic than ecstatic? Yesterday on The Connection, we talked about the sonnets of Shakespeare, 400 years old, still powerful in their expression of love. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Today we shift to the 20th century, the English poet Philip Larkin, who was also a jazz critic and fond of the music that you're listening to right now. He was as different from Shakespeare as one could imagine. Larkin writes not of comparisons to a summer's day, but of his own arid interrogation of bricked-up gates and a cold sun, the bright incipience of love sailing above. Is that love poetry? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're happy to welcome back Michael Girintosh as our literary guide. Michael is a fellow at St. Catherine's College, Oxford University, where he teaches English literature. And Michael, it was you who told us that we should be taking a look at Philip Larkin. Why do you want us to look at his work?
Well, I think for many reasons. He's an extremely fine poet. But yesterday, when we were talking about Shakespeare, I pointed out that the greatest definition of love, which I took from 1 Corinthians 13 in the Bible, was a wonderfully full, ample definition. And so I also think there's a huge value in looking at poetry which concerns itself with the difficulties of love. If I could take another biblical text, I take the great one, "He who saves his life shall lose it. He who loses his life shall save it." And often, certainly in Larkin, an obstacle to love is self-protectiveness. We want to save ourselves, with the result that we actually lose ourselves. We are too self-protective, we go into a state of paralysis. And it seems to me that Larkin wonderfully explores that.
Does he do it knowing exactly what he's doing, or do we get to watch him almost as voyeurs doing it?
Well, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. He did once say in a letter, "Never think I dispute the desirability of women. My quarrel is that their attainment is only possible on such unwelcome terms." He just couldn't do it.
See, there's nothing very romantic about what Philip Larkin has to say. And it brings me back to where we began the program yesterday, and that is trying to come to an understanding of the difference between whatever we think romantic poetry is and what love poetry is. Because there's a difference here, isn't there? And Larkin shows us that difference.
I think that one shouldn't take too narrow a definition of what romantic is. Let me quote the great French poet Jacques Prévert in English. He said at one point, and it's in the great film Les Enfants de Paradis, "If everybody who lived together loved each other, the world would shine like the sun." But we know the world does not shine like the sun. And it seems to me there's a huge value in poetry, which actually alerts people to the dangers, perhaps helps them to make themselves more courageous than Larkin felt he could be. That's surely a benefit. And it's love poetry. Is it romantic? Well, in our first poem, No Road, it has, I think, what Coleridge once said, "Great art is the balancing and reconciling of opposite and discordant qualities." Larkin is breaking off a love affair, but my God, he feels the pain. So the sense of love is strongly there.
All right, read us the poem, Michael, and then we'll take it up.
"Since we agreed to let the road between us fall to disuse, and bricked our gates up, planted trees to screen us, and turned all time's eroding agents loose, silence and space and strangers, our neglect has not had much effect. Leaves drift unswept, perhaps. grass creeps unmown, no other change. So clear it stands, so little overgrown, walking that way tonight would not seem strange and still would be allowed. A little longer, and time will be the stronger, drafting a world where no such road will run from you to me. To watch that world come up like a cold sun, rewarding others, is my liberty. Not to prevent it is my will's fulfillment, willing it my ailment. Can you think of a more tragic final rhyme, so corrosively ironic, than having a fulfillment, which is actually your ailment? The fulfillment is paralysis. It's no longer the joy of love. And it seems to me Larkin has wonderfully pitched the poem. This is not the moment of rupture. It's not the moment of break-off, which could be so dramatic. Nor is it happening years later. You mentioned Lord Byron in your opening, and you might think of his wonderful lyric, "When we two parted in silence and tears, half broken-hearted to sever for years." Byron is putting his poem years later. This is that horrible psychological moment in between, when Larkin is protecting himself. Not to prevent it is my will's fulfillment. But it's terrible liberty. It's like a cold sun. It's as if the energy of the world has been drained vampirically out. And he's generous enough to say that this sun in the new world will reward others.
He writes.
He's cutting himself off from it.
But he writes, though, in this one, Michael, as if he is looking back with great emptiness and misery over a 40-year love affair, which, you know, which has come apart. And yet, when he wrote this poem, he was still quite a young man, wasn't he?
He was 27. Mind you, a very brief but passionate love affair had come apart. I don't myself feel it's looking back over 40 years. I feel the pain of it so strongly. Our neglect has not had much effect. Leaves drift unswept, perhaps. It could be Shelley at his bleakest, or moodily atmospheric, like rainy wind through the abandoned gate of a fallen palace. Larkin just cannot walk that way tonight. It still would be allowed by the girl. He can't do it.
He's not a very good lover, is he? I mean, he's a complicated mess of a man in many ways, isn't he?
Well, if you want to bring in biography, which of course is a great modern concern, yes, he is a complicated mess. He was, in one sense, you know, he, in the latter part of his life, was keeping three ladies on the go at the same time. And they all adored him, and they all knew about each other, which is fairly extraordinary. When you say, of course, he's a mess, true. He, I think, is a mess in part. No doubt there are all sorts of other psychological factors, but in part because of the European trauma, which America was rather saved from. Larkin loved his father, but in the 30s his father was a Nazi sympathizer. He actually went to two of the Nuremberg rallies. He took Larkin to Germany. If it wasn't so ghoulish, one would laugh at the fact that Larkin's father had on the middle of his mantelpiece a replica of Hitler, and you pressed a button, and this replica went into a Heil Hitler salute. And when, after the war, Larkin's father died rather painfully and slowly of cancer, Larkin was hugely thrown and upset. So none of that helped. I think the other thing, too, is that, in a sense, Larkin was more swamped by what he saw as the spirit of the age than other people were.
What do you mean by spirit of the age?
Well, I mentioned at the end of our last broadcast the moment in Arthur Miller's wonderful autobiography when Miller sensed that the modern world was being born and was changing. It was a moment in the 50s when Miller said he heard the word lifestyle for the first time. And he realized that an earlier sense of community action being dominant in people's lives, people coming together to fight, whether it was trade union, Marxism or what, was actually being replaced by what Arthur Miller calls a kind of pointless competition in clothing, fashion, types of car, tastes and food, which actually led to a sort of nihilism. Now, Larkin, as we'll see in a moment, saw that nihilism in jazz. But, you know, if I'm asked, what are my favourite films at the moment? And I look back to the films that I really love, they're all in the 30s. They're the great films of Jean Renoir. What do I love now? Little-known films. The Russian director Klimov has a wonderful film called Come and See about the Holocaust in Belarus. I like Kieslowski's Decalogue about Thou Shalt Not Kill. Why do I like them? Because these films have a sense of humanity and character and vulnerability, if you like, of love. But it's coming over so incredibly bleakly.
Michael, let me ask you something, though, because Larkin died some 20 years ago, about 10 years ago. There were some selected works of his published, and people saw in that his Nazi sympathize, you know, his words of sympathizing with the Nazis, and some racial comments. They knew about his love of pornography, and there was a turning away from him there. People who had admired him started referring to him as a minor poet, and without sort of digging through all the refuse of the man's life, you began by saying, well, look, if you want to talk about biography, doesn't biography matter? Should we judge the poem or should we judge the poet? How do we look at this?
Well, I think it's very important to judge the poem. Biography is very complicated, you know. I mean, again, you mentioned Lord Byron. Well, Lord Byron was no model of marital fidelity and profoundly bisexual. In our earlier program, you mentioned Robert Burns and his wonderful poem, My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose That Newly Sprung in June. Look at Burns's life. People used to think he was a rather loving child of nature. We now know he was a tax collector and a rather avaricious one who was merciless to the poor. The awful thing about artists is that they tend to be very complicated. I'm not saying there aren't wonderful love poets. Robert Browning, whom I think is one of the greatest, was a model of love and loyalty to his wife, though his imagination just revelled in murder and erotic murder. I think with biography, it's fine enough, and it's, of course, an interesting area of study, but it's not the same as looking at works of art, and perhaps we should use that immortal line of love poets, please do as I say, not as I do.
And so when we come back after the break, we will look once again at the poetry of Philip Larkin. We'll begin with one which I think expresses what Michael's talking about, the sort of community action. It's a poem called Show Saturday. And we'd like to have you join our conversation about the way that love poetry has changed, is changing, whether or not it can be as bleak and as depressing and yet still express the very important emotions of love. 1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NPR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And if you, like me, are just learning about the poetry of Philip Larkin with our guest this hour, Michael Geerentosh, we invite you in to our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. You don't have to be an expert. You only have to have a question. 1-800-423-TALK. I said, Michael, before we went away for the break that I wanted to swing over to a poem, Show Saturday. Now, this is a long one. We're going to read sort of the last third of it. Is that about right?
Yes. Can I correct one thing you said in the first part?
Well, not on the air. I would be very embarrassed. No, of course you can't.
Well, please. It's an important point. I don't think there's any evidence that Larkin himself express Nazi sympathies. It was his father.
Okay.
And I think it's just an important point.
But why then was he tarred with that? Because it was one of the things that he was accused of.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, there was a time when a lot of his views were very unfashionable.
Right.
People didn't like the fact that he admired Mrs. Thatcher. Well, I liked Mrs. Thatcher at the time, and you can call me a fascist if you want, but I don't consider I am. And I think these things change. You know, people now see some more of the benefits of Mrs. Thatcher.
Right. All right. Show Saturday.
Show Saturday. The first part, as you say, describes the sort of show that still goes on, I'm happy to say, in the north of England and in Scotland.
And in America, it's called a county fair. It's the autumn gathering where people show their animals and bring their pies and things like that. Am I right?
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad it does. You know better about the States than me. And there are friendly wrestling matches. There are competitions with six brown eggs, six white eggs, four plain scones, and so on. And the poem has gone through all of that. And now everybody's going home. But now in the background, like shifting scenery, horse boxes move. Each crawls towards the stock entrance, tilting and swaying, bound for far-off farms. The men with hunters, dog-breeding, wool-defined women, children all saddle-swank, mug-faced middle-aged wives glaring at jellies, husbands on leave from the garden, watchful as weasels, car-tuning, curt-haired sons, back now, all of them, to their local lives, to names on vans and business calendars hung up in kitchens, back to loud occasions in the corn exchange, to market days in bars, to winter coming, as the dismantled show itself dies back into the area of work. Let it stay hidden there like strength, below sale bills and swindling. Something people do, not noticing how time's rolling smithy smoke shadows much greater gestures. Something they share that breaks ancestrally each year into regenerate union. Let it always be there. I love the poem because in a remark made by Yeats, if we can take up fascism, Yeats in the late 20s thought much of his famous poem, The Second Coming, written slightly earlier, in which he points out the centre cannot hold. The worst are full of passionate, the best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity. Now, this is about the sort of things where the centre does hold. These shows, these fairs, are innocent coming together of people. As Yeats observed, when things go wrong, the ceremonies of innocence are drowned. These friendly fights, these competitions, they're ceremonies of innocence. They may take place in a world where, sure, there's swindling. But nonetheless, the swindling is suspended for the show. It's a celebration of what's good, and one hopes it keeps the swindling at bay.
When I listened to you read it, I was hearing more of the music of a Dylan Thomas poem, that fabulous descriptive eye that he would bring to a poem. And when you talk about the way that all those people come together, and then, I mean, there's a corresponding sadness to the way that they all go back to their private addresses, gates and lamps and high stone one street villages. But why would you put it in the category of a love poem?
Well, he loves the people for what they're doing. Okay, it's not romantic, erotic love. But to praise what keeps the society together in the wider sense, is a form of love.
Mm.
Just as you might say that the paintings of Renoir, the painter Renoir, are full of love, as has often been said. He loves all the people he's doing. It's a matter of texture and what you celebrate and a delight in life as we live it every day.
Do you find Larkin, then, more skilled as an observer than necessarily as a participant in the way that he writes his poems?
Well, I suppose that's true, but provided the poems work, I don't really think it matters.
I'm trying to understand him in context of the way that we spoke yesterday of Shakespeare, who, you know, just leaps in and wallows not only in his own emotions, but teaches us a lot about ourselves by allowing us into his own delight and happiness and disgust and all those the emotions that he does. But there seems to be a more wistful observatory tone to Larkin.
No, no, of course you're right. Shakespeare is massively the greater poet. And, of course, if I can go back to that biblical distinction, he who saves his life shall lose it, he who loses his life shall save it. Shakespeare's sonnets are all about losing your life, observing the kindness, the non-self-seeking, the generosity of love. Larkin's poems, at least quite often, certainly in No Road, are about saving your life and, alas, losing it. But I think it's very valuable to have it expressed.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston now, and Andriana's calling us. Hi, Andriana. Thanks for calling.
Hi. No problem. Professor, what an interesting show. I've enjoyed the past 2 days so much.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My question, and I hope that you won't mind answering it, is I have an old copy of Lucky Jim, and Edward Gorey had actually drawn the cover illustration. And I noticed in that, which is something that I don't see in newer copies, that Kingsley Amis had dedicated that novel to Philip Larkin. And I wondered if you would be willing to comment on what you think the two men express in common about their views of love, Kingsley Amis in prose and Philip Larkin, who was just a wonderful poet, I think, in poetry.
Well, they were tremendously close friends. They were, of course, at Oxford together. And Larkin would astound Amis by making such remarks as, and this is an actual one we have in a letter, "My homosexuality is now being replaced by lesbianism," because he had written two pornographic novels which are lesbian. Amis and Larkin both had a sharp satiric eye, but Amis, you know, was able to lose his life. Larkin wasn't. And I think they were as unlike each other as chalk and cheese in that respect. They remained tremendous friends for the whole of their lives.
Andriana, what is it about Larkin's poetry that appeals to you?
Well, I think the professor says it so much better than I could, and I'm just a sort of a novice and flub around in a book of poems. You know, when you read his poetry, you really, it's very touching, but at the same time, you feel kind of pity for this person who seems so much on the outside looking in, even when he is writing poetry about relationships that he's in or he's over. But gee, when you think about it, I don't imagine that I would be any much more different than he would, or as the professor says, it's kind of a common symptom of our age. So I'm going to take my answer off the air.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you, guys.
Has she put that well, Michael?
Well, yes. I mean, again, in the last broadcast, I quoted one of our most eminent psychotherapists, Brian Thorne, who had the appalling thought that in modern life, fully loving people are, quote, becoming an endangered species. Now, thank God it's not true. I mean, large numbers of people marry, love each other, love their children, bring up wonderful children, or the human race would stop. But there is a horrible detachment in the culture of the age. And I think it is to do with what Arthur Miller puts his finger on. I think the nihilism is next door, for example, to the aestheticization of violence, which is so common in Hollywood movies and elsewhere, and is in a way sort of just on the horizon in the other poem I know we're going to look at, perhaps in the next half, for Sidney Bechet.
1-800-423-8255. Michael, you're so right. We will get to that poem in a minute, but we have a number of people who want to join us on the phone. So, to Barbara, who's calling in from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. Professor, it's very pleasing to hear you speak on the topic of love poetry and its place in today's hectic world. Thank you. I have a kind of a multi-question here. Would you speak to the love poem as a reflection of the object of desire, and that poem, perhaps, as a text of a dream, and also how the poem expresses the longing for what we cannot attain or experience, or perhaps what is past or lost.
Are you asking in your question, Barbara, whether or not a love poem is all of those things at once, or each one of those things individually?
Well, as expressed in individual poems, perhaps of Larkin and or Shakespeare, in contrast.
Yes, I mean many of Shakespeare's sonnets are, after all, about longing for what he can't obtain. It's a bit of a subtext, but on the other hand, the fact of Shakespeare's sonnets that we looked at is that in this longing, he observes generosity, not self-seeking, rejoices in the truth, all those things that I quoted from 1 Corinthians 13, and that makes the whole experience of a sort of wonderful, full, noble kind. I think it's fairly clear that Larkin would like to be like that. He just couldn't. He did actually write in one of his notebooks, "Never let me forget that the only marriage I have known, that of my parents, was hell." So that, as it were, I think a combination of something of the spirit of the age, which smothered Larkin in a way that it didn't smother Arthur Miller, for example, who after Marilyn Monroe had the huge good sense and grace to love and marry Inga Horvath. Larkin had, on top of that, this terrible marriage. And, you know, when people attack Larkin's character, he loved his father and he looked after his mother all the time after his father's death. He wrote to her unfailingly three times a week when he wasn't there. He bought her a house in Hull where he was working so he could be near her and she him. He was, in that sense, a most delightful and devoted son.
Barbara, does that get you anywhere closer to...
Yes, I was just thinking also as the poem and its place in today's hectic world. Are we seeing more poetry coming to the fore? For instance, Felix Dennis and his gathering of poets and friends of many different areas, people, common people as well as noble people, whatever, in England, and that seemed to be very successful, and his poetry seems very of the moment of today and seems like a burst of energy into the whole world of poetry. Could you speak to that? In other words, what is the place in today's hectic world? Where does poetry take its place?
I mean, the wonderful thing about art and poetry is something that Coleridge once said. He said it only about the greatest poets, but I think it's shared by others. It is the royal prerogative of genius to outstrip the taste of the age and form it. I love poetry which is trying to bring energy and delight based on truth and generosity more into people's lives. And as long as that goes on, long may it flourish.
But the interesting thing is that In many ways, Larkin isn't providing us with some kind of holiday or respite from the time and the age within which he wrote, but he's trying to put a voice to that. Do you see the difference?
Yes, I do. But I think that's right and noble. Again, I would quote that remark on love: it rejoices in the truth. So a holiday or a respite, which is getting away from the truth, is a delusion. And Larkin knew only too well that holidays or respites which shut out the truth too much were dangerous. It was the world of pornography which had, if you like, eroded him. So that I think finding a true voice is the most wonderful thing. And if that true voice gives you despair and your own disabilities, well, at least your readers can learn from that.
1-800-423-8255. Barbara, thanks for that call. Next to Wenham, Massachusetts, and Mark's with us. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Greetings, gentlemen. I was surprised to have Larkin appear on the show as a love poet. I don't know his love poetry at all. I don't know his biography very well. I know some of his more famous works: Church Going, Sad Steps, High Windows. I think maybe those pieces connect with the love poetry, though, as I think about it. The professor said a couple of terrific quotes that something in Shakespeare's sonnets, longing for what he can't obtain. That's how I view Larkin's poetry in general, I've always thought of him as a poet of deprivation, that he has high expectations, but over and over again in his poetry, those expectations are squandered or are sort of fall away, and he's left with rejecting those expectations. It's sad steps that wolves of memory, he sees the moon, a medallion of art, and then he turns away from it. And so that's how I view his poetry as it relates to love as well.
Yes, I mean, it's partly true. I think the crucial thing is that he doesn't turn away because other people have let him down. He turns away because he can't do it. And he finds love terribly difficult. And I just think that's its huge value.
Mm-hmm. I see that. And again, not knowing his biography, it sounds like he wasn't let down. In fact, his mistresses and wives or whatever were quite faithful to him, even, as you said, with knowledge of each other. I feel, as the previous caller, a certain sense of pity for him. And you were quoting Professor St. Paul, love does not delight in evil but rejoices with the truth. There is certainly a truth in Larkin. For me, I love his treatment of the poetic form, his line breaks, his rhymes that are so nuanced, as you said, fulfillment and ailment, that's incredible. But there's also a quite a dense sadness there that seems to me sometimes almost a holiday, and the opposite of a holiday. You know, you were saying holidays can be delusions that sort of outstrip the truth. For me, this also dabbles in some sort of Fort Labor camp or something, you know, where he's constantly feeling quite grim. But
Mark, I have to stop you there because we're coming up to a break. But I want to thank you for your observations on the poetry. You clearly read this man well. And we'll come back after the break with For Sidney Bechet. It's a poem that tells us a little bit more about Philip Larkin. In fact, one area where he does seem to be able to be a little less restrained when he writes about his love of jazz. 1-800-423-8255 for you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about and listening to the poetry of Philip Larkin this hour on the program. Not necessarily on the top 10 of people who we automatically think of as love poets, but certainly one who makes us think about the nuance of that emotion in ways that are either a holiday from or a little bit of deprivation from the emotions we classically associate with romantic poetry or love poetry. We actually, one of the neat things about radio that we occasionally get to do is hear the sound of somebody's voice, and it takes you a little bit to a time and a place. Mr. Larkin's been dead some 20 years now, but we did get from the web a little bit of him reading and from a particularly well-known poem of his. We'll just listen to the first verse of Philip Larkin reading the poem Obad.
I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there, unresting death, a whole day nearer now, making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation. Yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify.
That's the voice of Philip Larkin reading his poem, Obad. My guest on the program this hour, Michael Guerin-Tosh, fellow at St. Catherine's College, Oxford University, where he teaches English literature. And, Michael, you knew Philip Larkin, or at least met him a couple of times?
No, he used to come and stay with me. He was a great friend of my dear friend Rachel Trickett, whom I lived with, and often stayed with us. He was adorably funny and witty, and in a sense, I don't much like you, playing his voice like that on death. He wasn't like that at all in life.
What do we hear there that clashes with the Philip Larkin who you recall?
He's rather reciting. He had a huge sense of comedy. You've only to read his letters. They're some of the funniest letters ever written. He had a very dry wit. I remember him once saying to me a remark. It's not been put in any biography. Yes, Michael, I'm an agnostic now, but an Anglican agnostic. And he loved that sort of playing with words and fun. I'm not in the slightest surprised that three ladies loved him and were prepared to share him.
All right. For Sidney Bechet, this is a poem that shines another light on a side of the man, this his affection for music, I guess.
Can I say to your listeners that you slightly twisted my arm to read this? I was brought up in Scotland, where what we have is bagpipes and Gaelic music. So to expound to you a poem about jazz makes me feel very uncertain. And if anyone wants to bite my head off because I've got something wrong, please fire away and do so.
You'd be delighted to know that most of the people in this country who expound on jazz are no better at it than you are. They just expound. So.
Well, I think they're very much better. Anyway, the quick point that is, I think, important before one gets into it, is that Larkin, who wrote about jazz, simply adored the golden age of jazz. In other words, the 30s, even the 20s. His heroes were Sidney Bechet, or, and I may not pronounce these names correctly, Bix Beiderbecke, that first generation of people. He really disliked Charlie Parker and John Coltrane when they came along. He felt that they were, and it's rather Arthur Miller's point, he felt that they were driving the humanity out of jazz. He actually said of Coltrane, a new inhumanity emerged. And he thought that, and this is a wonderful phrase which you might let me quote, what had happened to the music of what I'll call the Afro-American player? What happened now was that it got full of conga drums and sambas and all the tawdry trappings of South America, the racket of Middle East bazaars, the cobra coaxing cacophonies of Calcutta. I bet he enjoyed writing that.
Gone was the sort of simple love of the blues, I guess, which was another of his.
Yes, I mean, as it were, it was Baghdad, I'm afraid, at its worst, taking over. So in this poem, what he's really doing is drawing a distinction between the golden age of jazz, which he loves in Bechet, and the others, which he hates. And Bechet, of course, had these wonderful notes, which you had at the beginning, on a soprano saxophone. That note you hold, narrowing and rising, shakes like New Orleans reflected on the water. And in all ears appropriate falsehood wakes, building for some a legendary quarter of balconies, flower baskets and quadrilles, everyone making love and going shares. Oh, play that thing. Mute, glorious Storyville's others may license, grouping round their chairs sporting house girls like circus tigers, priced far above rubies, to pretend their fads, while scholars monkey nod around unnoticed, wrapped up in personnels like old plaids. On me, your voice, Sidney Bechet's voice, on me your voice falls, as they say love should, like an enormous yes. My Crescent City is where your speech alone is understood and greeted as the natural noise of good, scattering long-haired grief and scored pity. It seems to me, the energy of Bechet, he's shaking, he's waking, it's noisy. What he hates is the muting in the technical elaboration of the others. The new jazz may be glamorous, it's taken up by record companies, Storyvilles, but actually it's like a brothel. It's like sporting house girls, like circus tigers, pretending the fads of their clients, quite unlike what he feels Bechet has, which is a sense of everyone making love, and because they're poor, going shares on the money. And naturally, this natural noise of good will contain grief and pity. It's the real origins of jazz and popular music in its tradition behind the 30s. He hates the way that is being pushed out.
Well, I thought when he said it, scattering long-haired grief and scored pity, he's saying rather that the natural noise of good is sending those away.
I don't think so. I think the natural noise of good is, as it were, expressing them. The long-haired people are people who are just poor and not shaved. I know it can be read the other way, the line, but I don't think that's what he's saying.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Burlington, North Carolina. Steve's joining us. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Are you a fan of this man's poetry?
Oh, intensely so, yes. One of the things I'm most impressed with is a certain informal tone, and sort of the topics are often commonplace, but all that is sort of couched in a very tightly constructed formal poetry. And my question is...
You're right. His sense of form is just wonderful.
Oh, it's amazing and very complicated and exact. I was wondering if there's a sense, though, in which form is constricting or limiting in that you're required to follow certain rules, that the word you choose might not always be the best word, but that it fits the rhyme or the meter. Is there anything limiting about restricting yourself to formal poetry?
Well, great poets find the rhymes and make them work. After all, Shakespeare's sonnets, the sonnet is a very restricted form. Shakespeare does it in it. I agree, it's a tremendous challenge, but then that combination of tightness and spontaneity is, in the remark of Coleridge I quoted earlier, exactly the balance and reconciling of opposite and discordant qualities. Sort of thing that makes art work.
Larkin talked about his construction of a poem sometimes as like knitting, didn't he?
I suppose many poets might have done, but it's very strenuous, exact knitting.
And Steve, do you...
And yet it must not appear to be strenuous.
It must appear to be completely natural or
absolutely,
or tossed off.
Well, definitely, if you can pull it off, I think it's as good as it gets, but it's just, it takes a master.
Do you see him or hear him as a love poet or as a poet able to express some of those more intricate emotions, Steve?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't limit him to love poetry. That's not the first thing, obviously, that pops into my mind. But I think it's constructive to talk about him that way. I like the way you guys have talked about him in that sense.
I'm just listening here. I'm learning as we go along. Steve, thanks for your call.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Nice to have you on the program. To Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Polly, you're with us. Go ahead. Hi, Polly. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to... I came on back in the love poetry, but I wanted to put in a plug for An Arundel Tomb, which I think it's one of my favorite poems, and I think it is about both... that tentativity that you were saying that Larkin had, but his need to say that love is the lastingest thing.
Yes, I mean, of course you're right. But of course, it's the love only of these two people on their tomb which has lasted over the years. And of course, Larkin, in his funny way, does have before that final line, which is so famous, what will survive of us is love. And the line is, and to prove our almost instinct almost true.
Yes.
I mean, for you and me, it's a full instinct, and it is true. There is just that strange note of sort of not quite there in Larkin.
But just before that, Polly, he says, time has transfigured them into untruth. No, he's teasing, isn't he? Playing with what is real and what is not in this poem.
Yes, but there is the tomb, and there we come to see it as I've seen it, and it proves, he says, our almost instinct, almost true, that what will survive of us is love, and that is an eternal.
Yes, I think you're right, Polly, and I think the untruth simply refers to the fact that society has changed. This is an unarmorial age, as he's just said, as I recall, a few lines before. So they're untruth in the sense that they're no longer representative of their times.
So, Michael,
I agree, it's a bit of a tease, but I mean, I think that's what it means.
So what's the lesson here, Professor? I mean, where are we in understanding the love poetry of Philip Larkin as a voice of contemporary love? Does he show us that our understanding of that emotion has changed, or it's that our ability to express it has changed?
You think me very pedantic. When you use the word lesson, I want to quote back to you a remark of Chekhov, the great dramatist, in his letters, where he says, "It is never the function of art to give lessons or to provide answers. It is the function of art to pose the questions correctly."
All right, skip the lesson. Help me with my questions.
Well, in a sense, your word tease is right, but he's just truthfully telling you how he feels in that moment. He feels, here are these extraordinary figures on the tomb. It is extraordinary that they're holding each other's hands. Does this prove that what will survive of us is love? Perhaps it does. I don't think the poem's going further than that.
Leaving us then with the question.
Yeah.
Was he a sad man, Philip Larkin?
Well, as I've said to know, he was full of fun and comedy. I think underneath he was sad. But I also think that probably if he was sitting here now, in his dry way, he would probably say, well, on the whole, I was doing my best. You know, in that, if you exclude the vulgarity, other famous line of his, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. Well, I suspect his did. And, you know, it was a difficult hand to play.
Michael, thank you so much for your time over these past 2 hours of Love Poetry.
Thank you.
Pleasure having you on the program.
And thank your callers.
They heard you. Michael Girintosh with us on our program. You can continue the conversation. Find us at our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Jennifer Giles and Sarah Ligon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.